Do you actually get excited to go vote? Why not? Is it because you're forced to choose between the lesser of two evils?
We think there's a better way. Today, we're diving into different electoral systems, their pros and cons, and what systems could lead us out of that lesser of two evils conundrum.
I'm Dan Wavering with my co-host Cassie Henderson Wynn, and this is Beyond Party Lines. All right, so we're talking about ranked choice voting today. First, I think it makes sense to talk about where are we now? What's our system like? What is the benefit of it? And where are we kind of going wrong with what we're doing today in the U.S.? So what are your thoughts, Cassie?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now in the U.S., for general elections, we follow what's called plurality voting, which is basically just whoever gets the most votes wins. And that doesn't mean that that represents the majority. It's just if you get 5 votes and the other person gets 4 votes, you win the election.
Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense, I think, to me, and I think to probably a lot of people. You know, it's very common sense. If you get more votes than the other guy, you should probably win. So on the surface, it feels really good. It's probably the simplest possible election that we could have. There's really no finer details. It's just if you get more votes, you win, and that's it. So, you know, there are benefits, obviously, to what we're doing, even if you feel that the current system isn't supporting your point of view or your candidates. So what are some of the benefits of how we're doing it right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first is what you said. It's really super simple and straightforward. It's easy for voters to understand. It's easy to follow. You know exactly what's happening. You go in once, you cast your vote, and that's it. Yeah, there's no finagling or trying to figure anything out, which is really nice. You get quick results, and you know, just one election definitely saves money. Elections are really expensive, and I don't think people really think about how expensive they really are. But we're throwing a ton of money into elections every year.
And so you're really just talking about the administrative cost of running an election, right? We're not talking about what candidates are spending or political parties. This is just what it takes to get in there, get the machines out, process the votes, count everything, make sure it's secure, all of those details, right?
Yeah. And it's mainly mailers to tell people about the voting, ballots, training for poll workers, and that sort of thing. And it really is. It doesn't even go into anything else like what campaigns are spending or anything like that.
Gotcha. Okay. So really with our plurality voting, we've got it's easy. It's quick. You typically get your results, you know, within a few hours. Sometimes, of course, if it's really, really close, it takes a little bit longer. You have to go in. Recounts happen, of course. Extenuating circumstances like our most recent election, then it might run a little bit longer. But typically, it's very fast. And then, you know, because it is more simple, you're going to spend a little bit less on the administrative cost of actually just processing that election. So there are obviously some benefits to how we're doing it now. But I think if you're listening right now, you're probably thinking, yeah, okay, but I got a lot of problems. If you're a Seinfeld fan, you know, I got a lot of problems with you people, you know, if you're a Festivus fan. So let's get into those problems. So, you know, plurality voting, it's called first past the post. You may hear it discussed that way. The biggest issue right off the bat, I think, for most of us is you can win without a majority. And it's not necessarily just not a majority, talking about 49%, but in some examples, it can be very, very extreme. And so in 1992, there's a member of parliament that won their seat with just 26% of the votes. And so something that I'm constantly advocating for, and I think a lot of people would love to see, are more political parties. You want more options. But with our current system, more options potentially just raises more issues. And that is, if you have 4 really good options, then somebody could win with 26% of the vote if it really gets split. And so it's a real concern that a lot of voters have. And obviously, it's fleshed out with, you know, voters winning a really small percentage of that electorate. But we don't even have to go far back, or we don't even have to go overseas to find a really good example of voters or of candidates not winning with a majority. We can go to the 2020 election that just happened. Yeah. So in the general election, you know, we had 7 candidates for the House of Representatives that won with less than 50% of the votes.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just really shocking. I think plurality voting makes sense on the surface, like we keep saying, but it just should not be that the candidate that wins does not represent the majority of the voters that voted in the election, much less the majority of the actual population, you know? And that's the thing is ideally, however many people go to vote, whatever percentage of that is, it needs to reflect the population in general, right? And there's just no way that it does that if you're coming in with 26% of the vote or anything less than 50.
Yeah, absolutely. Just it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. And plain and simple, it's not reflective of the population that that candidate's going to present to represent. I want to talk about a particular incident in the 2020 election. There's a candidate out of Utah for the House of Representatives, Burgess Owens, and he actually won his seat with 47%. So again, we're talking about a candidate that he unseated the incumbent. We're talking about a candidate that didn't win the majority. But what's even crazier to me is he actually only won his primary with 47% of the vote. So he didn't even have a majority of his own party supporting him to get him through the primary, 44%. And then he didn't have a majority of the general population that's going, he's going to be representing, represent him either. And so, I mean, really, that one's just as clear as day. And then we talked about the seven other candidates that didn't get 50%. But how many more are getting 50 or 51 or 52 or 53% of the vote? You know, yeah, it's a majority, but there's a good percentage of those candidates that are getting support from their voters in 5, 10, however many percent are voting against the other candidate. You know, they're just supporting them to get them over that 50% because they feel like they have another option. You know, those are the people that are swallowing really what they think is best and just going with what's second best. And then they're not really having their actual voice represented in the election there.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about is Duverger's law, which came into discovery in the 50s. There was actually a French political scientist named Maurice Duverger, and he did a lot of studies around the whole world about different political systems and different electoral systems. And he basically said, it's pretty much guaranteed if you have plurality voting, there is going to be a two-party system and nothing else. And it makes sense, right? Because from the party side, if you're a third party, yeah, I mean, how much effort and money are you going to throw into running a candidate that is likely not going to win? And then from the citizen side, we've seen it over and over. Like, you don't want to waste your vote, and you don't want anyone else wasting their vote and electing the candidate that you don't want in office. So it's just sort of really hated on this whole third party voting in general. And I think we've seen it. He's right. Like, plurality voting is tied directly to the two-party system.
And it turns people really nasty, too. I remember back in the 2016 election, and, you know, I voted third party. I did not vote for one of the major two candidates, and I felt as good as I could about my vote. I felt proud that I voted for the person that I thought represented me the most in that election. And then, you know, I went and talked to people after the election. I saw people on social media that I know, and all the discussion was about how me, you know, not specifically me, but me as a third party voter, I was the one that made Donald Trump get elected. And of course that was news to me because first of all, if I vote third party, you know, that's not how math works.
Right.
But, but beyond that, you know, it's just, it was shocking to see how many people, even ones that I typically am close to agree with on a lot of issues, were so quick to try to disenfranchise me, essentially, and say that, you know, I shouldn't vote for who I want to get elected because, you know, they hate one candidate so much that they're willing to blame me, who just simply was voting for who I thought was the best candidate. They're willing to blame me for getting that person elected. And so it's really crazy to see how polarizing this system is. It has been, but it seems like it's increasing in how extreme it is almost every day.
I agree. And I think that the 2016 election is an example of where it was really at peak. But I don't think, based on what I've seen, that it has diminished at all. And it's really interesting because obviously 2016 had two, whatever you feel about them, there were two very polarizing candidates, right? Yep. And people didn't really, like, a lot of people didn't like either one of them. And so they were searching for these third party people that represented more closely their ideals. And it's so interesting that we do this where we're like, oh, you can't do that. Like, you're electing the other person. Because again, as we said, it's not how math works. But even more so, I think it's so interesting that we are so ingrained in the system that we have that we're more willing to vilify individuals for voting for who they believe in, then we're willing to say, hey, if you can't vote for who you believe in, that's a sucky system that's not working how it's supposed to work, right? And it's not representing anybody.
Exactly. Yeah, let's look at, you know, a little internally on, are we even doing the right thing here? Because right. If somehow we've turned ourselves into these monsters, and I feel this way a little bit, and I know a lot of people do, but, you know, the two-party system, that's an ideal situation for them. A citizen going after another citizen for voting for an independent candidate, that's what the major parties dream of, because that's really just enforcing that this is the system we need, you know, this is what works. And it's really getting any of those independent candidates really off the board, and then they can really just not have to worry about the 40% of people in the United States that identify as an independent. You know, they don't have to worry about that at all. They can focus in on the 30% that are their constituents that identify as a Democrat or a Republican. And that's really it. So yeah. We're here to talk about another way, right? What's
exactly. Yeah.
What can we do to change this around?
Yeah. So Duverger said that, you know, this isn't working. The plurality system is going to be linked to two-party system. And one of the things that he advocated for was either you have to have some kind of a different system where it's not like a winner-take-all, or you have to have a runoff. And I think that runoff is the kind of natural answer to it. And it's something that we have in place to an extent in the U.S. And so do you want to just talk for a second about what runoff voting is?
Yeah, so runoff is very, very simple. Basically, if you don't get to 50%, so you don't get a majority of the votes, then the top two candidates advance to a runoff vote. It's usually a couple months later. People go back to the polls, and they cast their vote for the candidate that they want to win. And because there's only two candidates left on the ballot, then you will get a majority in that second election.
Yeah, and I think it probably sounds familiar to at least some of our listeners, because several states in the U.S. have runoffs in place, at least for the primaries. You know, Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, and Vermont have this in some form, whether that's for every primary election or sometimes it's only for gubernatorial elections. In Vermont's case, it's only if there is an actual tie. But I think that this concept is something that most people have heard about and understand, even if their state doesn't have it in place. And it certainly has some benefits. Do you want to touch on those a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if we look at just what's going on right now, you know, Georgia has a special election that's going, or a runoff election that's going to be happening in January. One of them is for their special election. And there's two for both of their Senate seats. And, you know, it's getting a lot closer to building consensus, because people are going to have another voice. If you went to the polls and you voted for the Libertarian or another independent candidate in one of those elections, and that person didn't make it to the runoff, well, you're not too worried, because then you get another chance to at least vote for your next favorite. But there's obviously some pretty big problems too, right?
Yeah, kind of, I would say some staggering problems. One in particular, and that's that requires a separate election. And as we already talked about, that's extra money, extra expense. But more so than that, there is pretty much across the board a huge drop in voter turnout from the first election to the runoff. In some cases, this is really bad. Now, across the board, it's 35% for primaries. So that's going to be most of the time you're dropping 35% in voter turnout when you go into a runoff. But sometimes it can get even worse. And I have a very fun little case study that just happened in my city. And by fun, I mean pretty much completely disheartening because we actually just had a mayoral race. And in the general election, the November presidential election was when this race came into place. And the winning candidate of that race had 24,889 votes, which was 48.51%. And in my county, that triggers a runoff. So here comes the runoff. Okay. 31% of the people that voted in the general election voted in the runoff. So that's a drop of 69%. And by the time that actually was calculated, 8,465 votes went to the winner, which reflects a 6% of our population and 16% of how many people voted in the general election.
So you're saying of the few people that actually did go and vote in the runoff election, then they really got their voices heard. Even if they voted third party, then they had a chance to elect the mayor. But pretty much anybody else, which is the vast, vast majority of the population in that town, didn't have a say at all.
Yeah, and it kind of begs the question, is this doing what it's supposed to be doing? Because the entire point of the runoff is that we're trying to get it to reflect more citizens, more voters. We want it to make sure that the majority is voting. But when the majority is a majority of 16% of the population, that's not a majority. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, what's the point at that point? It's definitely not doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's just causing problems. And this is, you know, one specific example, but I couldn't find a single case that was reported on where there were more voters in the runoff than in the general.
Right. So even if, let's say in an ideal world where everyone, you know, getting to work and taking off work isn't a problem, and so everyone can go and you get 100% of the people that have voted in the initial general election and they go and they vote in the runoff election. So even if you have 100% and it's a better system because of what we just talked about, you know, third-party representation, still having your vote counted and all that. So even if that happens in an ideal world, then we're still talking about the administrative cost of funding a second election, having to process all those votes, having to get volunteers, all of that. But we haven't even discussed all the candidate spending. A lot of us would probably just say candidate waste. You know, I think the crazy numbers that have been thrown around for the Georgia election in January are just something crazy. We're talking billions and billions of dollars just for two candidates, just for their second runoff election. And that's the spending that's getting dumped into those beyond what the cities and states are paying to process this. And that's in an ideal situation where everyone actually goes and votes, which, as you said, Cassie, pretty much never happens.
Yeah. And you know, we have a really bad voter turnout rate as it is. You know, I was looking back at even for the presidential elections, the highest that I saw since like 1950, I only looked at, you know, the last 60 years or whatever, it was 62%, I think, in 1960. Wow. So, and that's for a presidential election where people are really excited about it and everybody knows about it. And generally you have time off work or, you know, you're aware of early voting and, you know, much less these little runoffs where you're juggling all these plates in your life and you're expected to stop what you're doing and go vote for one race for somebody who you might not be that aware of or know anything about.
Yep. So we're talking about general elections have the best turnout typically. Best case scenario, those is even 2/3. Local elections have a smaller turnout. And then if you compound it even further on a local election that had a runoff, you're talking about, you know, you get to that 5-10% of the population number. So that's not even close to representative. That's just potentially the most vocal people having their say and basically nobody else. So we've maybe made a step, maybe not, if we go from plurality voting to runoff voting. That's kind of debatable. But there's a way, and that's what we're talking about now, to take kind of the best parts of runoff voting and eliminate some of the worst parts of it. And that's what we're talking about, is ranked choice voting. So you've probably heard the words ranked choice voting, but you've never actually been able to understand it, or you've heard some convoluted explanation. So I want to break it down as simple as we possibly can. Ranked choice voting. Instead of just choosing one candidate like we do now, voters rank each potential candidate in order of the preference. That's it. So if you choose a guy and you know what, he only gets 3% of the vote, well, you've got a second choice and you can choose that next candidate that happens to get 40, 50, 60% of the vote and you still have a say in the election. I mean, it's that simple. That's the whole thing. Really, really immediate. A lot of places you'll see it written as instant runoff voting. So it's runoff voting, except it happens instantly. And so there's a ton of benefits to that. Like we talked about, all the spending, all of that spending issue, or most of it, I guess, is gone because you're not doing a second election. So you're not running everybody out for more administrative costs. You're not running out the candidates to campaign for another month or two and spend more money there. It's just happening right away. There are potentially some other spending implications we'll get into here in a minute, but there's tons of good benefits. So Cassie, take us through what you see as kind of the top things here.
Yeah, I would say the first and biggest is that it eliminates that spoiler effect, which is what we kind of touched on a couple of times earlier, where if, you know, we pretty much have Republican and Democrat, and if you get a third party in there, that's progressive, for example, that's going to split the vote between the Democrat and the third party progressive candidate, pretty much ensuring that the Republican candidate will win, and vice versa. If you get a very conservative third party, that's going to split the vote between the Republican candidate and the very conservative third party and pretty much guarantee the Democratic candidate is the winner. And it kind of goes into that idea that you're wasting your vote, you're helping to vote the other person in, you're the villain, right? Exactly. So that spoiler effect is a big problem. And I think that that's the biggest benefit of ranked choice voting to me.
So in the 2020 election, if there was a candidate who voted for the Libertarian candidate, Joe Jorgensen, and obviously I think she got less than 1% of the vote, but you wanted to actually have your voice heard and say, you know, maybe you're a Libertarian and that she aligns perfectly with you, but you don't want to have no say in the election. So in the 2020 election, what you would have done is put Joe Jorgensen as your first choice, and you would put Donald Trump probably, but maybe not. It could have been Joe Biden, just depending on what your beliefs are. Then you put your second choice as one of the two candidates that are left, and then you still get your vote to count. You still are able to show your support for Joe Jorgensen, but then you get your voice on Donald Trump or Joe Biden.
Yeah, and it really opens up the possibilities for these third-party candidates because, yeah, Joe Jorgensen got less than 1%, but how many people wanted to vote for her? How many people aligned more with what she said? And they chose not to because they knew that it was a waste of a vote. They knew that it wasn't viable.
Yeah, and some of those people don't just vote for one of the two main candidates. They don't vote at all. You know, a lot of the progressives or a lot of the libertarian or very fiscally conservative candidates or fiscally conservative voters just stay home because they look at the two candidates and say, those aren't even close to what I believe in whatsoever. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to work and just totally avoid this madness.
And, you know, the majority of people are settling if they vote for one of the two main candidates. That's not representative of most people. And I think that most people go in and feel like they're casting a vote against somebody instead of casting a vote for somebody.
And I also think about how many candidates, actually potentially good candidates, aren't getting into politics because of the issues that we're talking about right now. You know, there's a lot of people out there would probably be a really good representative or a really good president or mayor or really anything. But they look at the Democrats, they look at the Republicans, and just like voters, they say, these people don't represent me whatsoever. I can't run as a one of these main candidates. And then they look at, you know, the smaller parties or running as an independent, and they know typically you have very, very, very low possibility of getting elected that way, and they just stay out completely.
Right, because if you're in that situation, your choices are bite the bullet and join into a party that I don't believe in, or waste everyone's time and money, including your own, to go run for an election that you have no chance of winning.
So if we do ranked choice voting, then if that happens, you're going to get a better consensus, right, of the electorate, of the voters actually having a choice. So there's going to be a wider spread approval, because even if your candidate doesn't win, like the Joe Jorgensen, then you're going to have some sort of voice and a higher percentage, usually 50 plus, but obviously there are some outside cases, but hopefully even higher than that percentage of the people are going to say, you know what, maybe that's not my ideal candidate, but it's at least not the person that I hate.
Right. And right. It really is designed to get to that 50 plus, same as the runoff voting, but it totally takes out that problem of people not showing up, because it's instant, like we talked about. But there actually are some other kind of off the wall benefits. Not off the wall in that they're not important, but things that you wouldn't necessarily think of right off the bat.
Lame on me.
Yeah. I think that the biggest one is more positive campaigning. So at first you might think, oh, what does that have to do with anything? But if you know that you're competing for even a second choice spot instead of a first choice spot, you're not going to go publicly smear this other candidate and completely ostracize all of the voters that might choose you as the second choice. And I mean, I think everyone's tired of hearing negative campaigning.
Well, plus, you know, if there's a third party candidate running and they start to get more support, then the candidate that most closely aligns with that independent third party candidate can't just ignore those other voters and say, well, they're voting for me regardless, or they're voting for the other person regardless, so it doesn't matter, my platform isn't going to represent them. They have to look at that, those supporters of that third party candidate, and say, how can I gain their support? Maybe I need to change my platform a little bit to include some of the issues that they care about the most. And so, you know, you're not only getting more positive campaigning, but then also potentially, again, everyone's voice is being heard, not just from the voting aspect, but what issues actually get put forward from the winning candidate ultimately.
Right, because as it is, these sort of the people on the very outsides, on the left and the right, are more or less completely ignored by the DNC and the RNC because they don't matter. Mathematically, they don't matter. They're outliers, right? And it would be nice to actually matter, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the other kind of interesting benefit is actually that candidates are more likely to try to go out and campaign in person. And you know, we see this in the presidential election. We see the candidates going to different places. In local elections, it does not tend to happen nearly as much. And a lot of times you're going in and you're just filling in a bubble for a name that you don't even know who this person is.
Yep.
And, you know, a lot of times they're not politically aligned. So you just get two names, and they don't have a D or an R next to the name, and you have no idea. So it's really beneficial for you in this case to not just go off of, oh, I'm the incumbent and my name is on a sign that most people have seen, and I have the biggest sign in town, but to actually go to events and to hold town halls and to have debates and sort of show up face to face with your voters and make sure that they actually know who you are, because you might be their second choice, and that matters.
You're saying something really crazy here, Cassie. You're saying that potentially these candidates might speak to the people that they're going to be represented?
Yes. Isn't that odd?
What a concept.
So crazy.
So it sounds great, but obviously no voting system is without issues. So I think we would be remiss if we didn't at least discuss some of the potential downfalls, because it's important that we cover really all the pros and cons in my mind. So one of the biggest issues, and we've seen this where ranked choice has been rolled out in other cities and states and countries, is there is a learning curve. Because right now, again, you go, you check the box or you fill in the circle for the candidate that you want to win over the other candidates. That's it. We're talking about, you know, there will be more candidates, which is obviously great. But if you have four candidates, then there's four people to research instead of just typically two, which is what most people are used to. And then not only are you going to vote for one, but you're going to vote for all four in some capacity, first through fourth, potentially. And it does, in some cases, cause voters to fill out the ballot incorrectly. So there are potential problems with disenfranchisement if voters do fill out, let's say, two first-place bubbles and two second-place bubbles instead of one first-place, one second, one third, one fourth, or however many candidates there are. So that's a real issue, which is really more of a short-term issue because, you know, there are campaigns that can be run to educate the electorate on what the process is. But the first few times that it gets implemented, you know, that's a real concern that has to be kind of worked through. And then, you know, voters don't have to rank all the candidates, which I think is more of a benefit of the system.
Yeah.
But if you don't rank all the candidates, let's say you rank the top three most conservative, and then there's two progressives and one of the progressives wins, but you don't vote for either of those in any capacity, then again, we're in the situation where you don't have a voice. But I think if we look at our current system, it's really, in that case, not much different than what's happening now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And any kind of a single winner setup, you know, you're going to have people that didn't vote for the winner. And that's the way that it is. I think the goal always is to represent the majority of people, which is what's obviously not happening right now. Yeah. And, you know, I think that it definitely is an issue. We cannot skirt around the fact that, yes, people might fill out the ballots incorrectly. Yes, there might be issues with that. And I think especially right now, where we're trying so desperately to get more people to vote, it's hard to wrap your mind around anything that complicates that process. You know, we hear people all the time say, oh, I've never voted. I can't, I don't have time, you know. But I think it's just one of those things, to a degree, we just have to do it and get over it, because it's not working as it is right now.
Right. We're talking about the pros or the cons of our potential new system, still not outweighing the cons of what we're doing right now. And so, yeah, unfortunately, that will happen. But, you know, next time they go to the polls, it's less likely to happen, opposed to our current system where, like we talked about earlier, you've got progressives and you've got conservatives that are staying home completely every single time because they're not represented whatsoever. And that's not really changing at all. So they're just perpetually staying home. And that's not getting any better. So,
absolutely. And then, you know, Maine, and we'll talk a bit more later about who's using this in the U.S. because there are places that are using ranked choice voting, but Maine did implement it a couple of years ago. And I was on their government website, and they just had this really great setup, I thought, on the website. They had this little 5-minute video that kind of explained everything about ranked choice voting and showed pictures of ballots and how to fill them out. It had FAQs, you know, where if you're more of a, I need to read it, I'm not a video person, it kind of had it all laid out. And I think that there's potential to have information like that even in the voting center, especially if you're saving money, hundreds of thousands of dollars per election. I think you could have some sort of effort at the voting site to explain how the ballot works.
So you mentioned Maine, mm-hmm. and this is, I think I've been shouting this for like 2 months now about Maine, because everyone was just deadlocked in this partisan discussion of the 2020 election, how everything is terrible, like nothing went the way, even if your candidate won, you know, nothing is going the way that you want right now. We're not getting anything done in Congress whatsoever. But I've been shouting, you know, hey, like something good happened in the 2020 election. And that's Maine was the first state to, or they were the only state to vote in the general election using ranked choice voting. And it's really frustrating because if you go on the major political websites, you go to Fox News, CNN, Politico, New York Times, any of those, the best that I could find was a footnote at the very bottom in the fine print saying, teeny tiny, yeah, Maine used ranked choice voting in this election. And then not even really an explanation of what it was. Most of the sites didn't even mention that Maine did the voting that way.
Yeah, it's been vastly undercovered. And that's kind of interesting. I sort of want to dive into that a little bit. Why the mainstream media has more or less completely ignored ranked choice voting across the board. You know, you'll find a Time magazine article or a Wall Street Journal editorial about how it's a terrible idea because it's too confusing or whatever. Yeah. But there's almost nothing. And I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Why do you think that is?
To me, it's really simple. Ranked choice gives a better voice to independent candidates and their constituents. And we know that the media typically, at least the mainstream media, and again, we're talking about CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, don't do a good job. And actually, there's a lot of evidence that they intentionally go out of their way to avoid covering third-party candidates. And so when you have media that's avoiding third-party candidates and you have, you know, the most hits on an article or a video are when there's a very, very partisan discussion amongst the two major parties, or you're talking about how much, you know, Hillary Clinton or how much Donald Trump is terrible, then there's an incentive really across the board for not only the existing two-party system, but also the media to really reinforce the system as we do it right now. And maybe that's a little conspiracy theorist of me, but I really think that's the practical state of where we're at right now.
No, I think so. And it doesn't even have to be, we think the news are evil. We don't think, you know,
right.
It doesn't have to be, it's a big conspiracy and they're trying to screw us over. It's just, any news source is biased, and they're not necessarily going to go out of their way to do something that's going to potentially take away from the candidate that they support.
Right. That's where their incentives lie. And so that's how they're going to keep reporting. Absolutely. And then the other thing that happened that was really great in the 2020 election that we didn't hear very much about at all, unfortunately, is fortunately, Alaska voted yes on ballot measure 2. And if you haven't seen ballot measure 2, I recommend that you do a little bit of research and look up at all the great things it's done. But one of the biggest things is they enacted ranked choice voting for general elections. So that has passed. And in future elections, Alaska will be able to use ranked choice voting in the polls. And actually, they passed finance reform and open primaries as well. So a lot of good things on ballot measure 2. So there are now two states, so we're 4% of the way to having ranked choice voting in all 50 states. So there is progress happening.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it was actually up on the ballot in Massachusetts, right?
Yep.
And that one did not pass. So
yeah, and there was a lot of support. I think it was 45%, 46%, somewhere in there of the voters actually voted yes.
Yeah,
but it's a really easy, you know, if you're a Republican, if you're a Democrat, and it's not in your best interest to have ranked choice for whatever reason, then it's really easy to say, this is complicated, let's vote no for it. And, you know, you do have to have a little bit of education or research into what it is. Otherwise, it does seem a little bit scary. And I think that's completely sensible, right? You know, if you don't know what ranked choice voting is when you go to the poll, you're probably just going to say, let's just stick with what we have because it seems like a scary prospect.
Yeah, I think it's always hard to break out of the status quo. We, in my city, in my county, switched to paper ballots after the 2016 election. And my husband, when we went in to vote the next time, just about had a cow. And he was like, I don't want to vote on a paper ballot. What is this? This is not what I'm used to. And so I think, you know, anything straight party voting, like there are these little changes that come up. And every time it's very bristly. Nobody likes change. You know, we like what we're used to. We like to be comfortable. But if comfortable is not reflecting the needs of the people, then we got to take a little bit of discomfort.
Right. I mean, what's a little bit of pain and discomfort to potentially have a better voice in our democracy, a more representative voice, right? So we've got some places. We've got Alaska now. We have Maine. We have some cities like San Francisco. I think they've been doing it for over 15 years. So they were pretty early on the ranked choice part. And I want to point out too, one of the great things in my eyes about ranked choice, it is specifically not partisan. So it benefits the people really, really well, whether you're a Republican, whether you're a Democrat, or whether you're, especially if you're an independent. So it's not one of the issues that really, yeah, it benefits Republicans a little bit, but it really benefits Democrats. It's really equal across the board. And I think you'll see that with Alaska passing it as a pretty heavily red state. Maine typically goes blue. Massachusetts goes blue, and they're talking about ranked choice. San Francisco, of course, is pretty blue. So it, really across the board, it's got a widespread benefit. But what about future places? You know, how does it get enacted? What do people do if they like the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think any time that we're talking about a change in political system, right, it's kind of like a little panicky. Like, is this going to have to be like a big federal overhaul? Does this have to go to the Supreme Court? And the answer is no. This fits right into the system that we have. It's ballot measures. It's things like this. It can go city by city, state by state, county by county. And the great thing I think about that is that people get to vote it in, right? Maine, they got to, well, that was a ballot measure, wasn't it?
Yep, it was.
Yeah. And Alaska was as well. So people vote it in, and Massachusetts, they chose not to this time, and maybe next time they will. Yeah. But I love that because even if it's a slow process, it reflects the will of the people. And that's really what it's all about at the end of the day.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great that it can be enacted by a ballot measure, because you're probably listening and you might be thinking this is a great idea, but Congress can't even agree on some very, very simple things, even when 80% of America agrees that it's a good idea. And so how are we ever going to get this past Congress? Well, you know, 26 states have ballot initiatives or some sort of referendum where you could potentially get this type of thing on the ballot and completely, you don't have to worry about your legislative branch whatsoever. Once you get a little bit more support, then as we've seen with a lot of other issues, state by state, then Congress starts paying a little bit more attention, and these initiatives start to get closer to passing.
That's it for ranked choice voting. If you want to dig in more, all of our sources for this episode and further suggested reading can be found in the show notes.
All right, we want to hear your thoughts. Tell us what you think about ranked choice voting. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. It's all at Beyond Party Pod. You should see our red, white, and blue Beyond Party Lines logo there. You know you're in the right place. And just drop us a note. Say, hey, is ranked choice voting the way to go? What are problems that we didn't discuss? What are some benefits that we didn't discuss? Do you happen to love what we're doing right now? Let us know, and we'd love to have a chat with you. Thanks for listening. Catch us next time. Beyond Party Lines.